This is Paul Schmid. Welcome to the Pursuit Zone. Ian Packham traveled around the coast of Africa for 13 months without the support of a backup team. It was a 40,000-kilometer journey using locally available public transportation, and although Africa has a coastline shorter than Europe, crossing the borders of 31 countries is no easy task, when corrupt regimes, poor infrastructure, and war may be around the next turn. Ian wrote a book about his adventure titled Encircle Africa, Around Africa by Public Transport, which you can learn more about at his website, encircleafrica.org. Ian Packham, welcome to the Pursuit Zone.
Thank you very much.
So Ian, from reading your book, I know this was not your first time in Africa. What was the purpose of you going there previously?
So I'd been to Africa three times before the Encircle Africa expedition, but that was merely sort of for holidays. But it happened to be quite helpfully divided up between various different regions. So I'd been to Ghana in West Africa, Gabon in Central Africa, and Kenya in East Africa, which gave me a nice sense of the continent as a whole.
Now, in the book, it also mentions that as a boy, you were very, very shy.
Yes.
So how were you able to get over that shyness and want to do a big adventure like this in Africa?
I think part of it's just growing up. You know, being difference between being 8 and being 28 is quite a long time to mature. But I also developed this sort of law where I force myself to go out of my comfort zone and to take risks that I wouldn't otherwise take.
Did you say a law?
Yeah, it's my own personal law.
Is the law just get out of your comfort zone, or are there more components to it?
It's basically a seize the day, I suppose, but it's do whatever my gut feels is right. So if my first instinct is to do something, then I shouldn't shy away from that, from thinking too much about it.
Now, what kind of preparations do you have to do for an adventure like this around Africa? What do you have to plan for ahead of time?
Well, I'll prefix this by saying that I plan quite a lot anyway, and if I was doing it again, I would probably just go. But I did quite a lot. Obviously, there's the health side of it. I spent about 2 months visiting my doctor for vaccinations and things like that. A little bit of fitness, just to make sure I could physically go on for 13 months. Although I was taking public transport, there was a lot of walking and carrying of kit and things like that. Then I made sure I knew just the basics of some of the main languages they speak in Africa. And as well as that, I spoke to as many people who'd been to the places I was going to and read as much as I could, whether it was fiction or non-fiction, just to get a sense of what I was going to experience there.
Now, are visas required for each country, or how do you handle the visa situation?
Yeah, I needed visas for pretty much all of the countries, barring those who see quite a lot of tourists, like South Africa. And actually, it's a lot easier to get visas from the neighboring country than it is from London. They ask a lot less of you, for one thing, and they see it's quite reasonable that you should be traveling overland, whereas if you try and get a visa in London, they sort of expect you to be flying in, so you have to show air tickets and things like that.
There were a couple of instances where they told you basically you have to go back to where you came from in order to get here or to go where you want to go.
Yes, I think that is a response to modern air travel that embassies can tell you, oh, you just fly back to London, get your visa there, and fly back to, you know, 100 kilometers from where you're standing, which is ridiculous. And normally, well, I did get my get away from that and managed to avoid having to do that, because that would really have ruined the principle of the trip.
You mentioned a bit about your kit. Tell us what you were carrying.
I was carrying what I think was quite a lot. Other people say I wasn't taking very much at all. Doing the whole coast of Africa, all different geographical zones, the weather is very different. So I basically had to take enough kit as if I was traveling for four seasons. So, for example, the coast of Namibia is very cold, as is Ethiopia, because it's very high up in altitude. Then I was traveling through most of North Africa in the height of summer, so it was very hot. So I had to be aware of having cold clothes and then stuff to cool me down. I had a tent with me. I had a little bit of food with me for emergencies, and I also had a big stack of books. So it was about 20 kilos in all, just carrying in a normal sort of backpack, which is quite a lot for me because I'm not a big built guy.
How would you describe the various regions of Africa?
It's actually really difficult, and traveling relatively slowly as I was doing, I almost didn't notice the change in regions until it was too late. But there are broadly defining features, I guess, of each, which comes partly from the geography of a place and partly, I think, from the colonial history as well. So West and Central Africa is still very much what I call a Francophone zone. It still leans towards the French sort of European way of doing things, whereas sort of South Africa up to East Africa is much more Anglophone and does things in a much more British way. And then you have North Africa, which is almost like coming back to Europe. It's very much Mediterranean. It's very like the southern Europe, places like if you visited Greece or Portugal, it had a very similar feeling to that.
I was really surprised by how much of an influence Portugal had on parts of Africa.
Yeah, so the main Portuguese bits of Africa are Angola and Mozambique, which, though they're still Portuguese-speaking, and they do have that sort of Portuguese vibe, if I can put it that way, of people, you know, sitting out on their doorsteps in the evenings and talking to their neighbours, there's a definite feel that they were being swallowed up by what I've already described as sort of Anglophone Africa. And I was told when I was in Mozambique that within 100 years, Mozambique would be an English-speaking country rather than a Portuguese-speaking one.
What did you have to allow yourself for a budget, and how do you handle and deal with all the different times that you have to change money along the way?
So how I worked the budget out was I looked through the guidebooks and saw for each country what they recommended for certain amounts of staying, and just added all that up to come with a very basic budget, which didn't end up being very cheap. It ended up about £20,000, which is roughly $34,000. So it's not actually cheap. Africa is quite expensive to travel in. But the way I dealt with that actually was through the use of technology. Traveling around the coast meant I was always near big towns and big cities, which was one of the points of the trip. And I think in every country I went to, there was one working ATM in the country, so where I could just take my bank card and withdraw what money I needed for the next week or so.
That's really surprising. $34,000.
Yes.
I thought you were going to say like $500.
For the whole trip? Wow.
Who would know? I mean, if you've never gone to Africa, who would know? You just think it's... you have this impression that everything's just going to be very, very inexpensive.
Yeah, I mean, Africa's not really set up for the travel I was doing. There are very few campsites and things like that. And obviously, I didn't have my own vehicle or backup team, so I was reliant on staying in what accommodation there was. Food is actually proportional to wages. Food is more expensive in Africa than it is anywhere else on Earth. And then you have the fact that I spent £2,000 alone just on visas to go through these 31 countries.
Speaking of food, what type of food are you eating there?
That's a good question. It does vary a little bit by geography, but you basically get a cheap carbohydrate. So you get rice or banana or potatoes or sort of a maize meal, just a mashed up porridge-like stuff. And at the very least, you'll get that with a spicy sauce. And you can get that as well with chicken or West Africa particularly. You know, they basically pick a fish out of the ocean, put it on a barbecue and give it to you. It's the most delicious tasting stuff in the world.
So let's talk about public transportation, because that was the main purpose for your adventure.
Sure.
Can you describe for us the different types of public transportation that you're on during this adventure?
If I was lucky, I found myself on a state-of-the-art modern double-decker coach like you would see anywhere in Europe or North America, but I wasn't lucky very often. Normally, you would see me in a minibus, so just a standard minibus of varying ages and varying amounts of damage to them. And there's another form of transport which we don't really have here. They're either called chair taxis or bush taxis, which is basically the same idea as a minibus, but it's in a car setting. So six or seven people will clamber into a car and all head off to the destination that the driver's heading for. And then in towns, a lot of places have motorbike taxis, which are a really cool idea. So they weave around traffic and get you to where you need to go to. And then on rivers and things like that, I was in sort of the traditional canoes and pirogues hewn from trees and just sort of stitched together.
Did you find people tried to take advantage of you and charge you more money?
The only place that was ever a problem was places that saw a lot of tourists. The place that springs to mind would be Cairo in Egypt. Wandering around the tourist sites there, obviously there's the pyramids. They've had tourists for thousands of years, so they try and charge you a lot more for everything, from water to tickets. But places that didn't see tourists, particularly sort of West and Central Africa, you could see it didn't even cross their minds to charge me more, because I was just a normal member of society passing through.
Another method that you employed was hitchhiking. Tell me about those experiences.
Actually, they were all very positive experiences, hitchhiking. I think in Africa, that is still, at least in the less developed parts of Africa, like Mozambique, that's still very much a way in which people travel. So it's not unusual to see people by the side of the road waiting for transport. And it's not unusual to be offered a lift. And I think in the entire 13 months and 40,000 kilometers, I waited no more than half an hour to be picked up when I was hitchhiking, which is better than some of the buses I had to wait for.
Now, as you're going along, people are constantly saying to you, it's not safe, you cannot go there. But you mentioned in your book that you always find this, for the most part, to be not true, to the point where you begin just to ignore it.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that?
I think it's just a sort of natural human condition to be wary of the unknown beyond. And most of the people I met haven't ever visited the neighboring country, even if they lived in the village on the border. And, you know, they didn't need a visa or anything. They just had no reason to travel there, so they didn't. And it was very hard to get across to people that I was traveling for fun, as it were. And I think that's purely the reason they were saying it was unsafe.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the countries that you went through. I was wondering if you can tell me, what are the three most memorable that you traveled through, and why would you say they're the most memorable?
I'll start off by saying I'm a big fan of places that people don't normally travel to. So that's probably part of it. But my three most memorable were probably Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria, simply because those are three countries in which we hear so much negative information from the news and from their histories. And for me to turn up there with all these expectations, which were completely turned on their head, and those are probably the three countries that the people there cared for me the most and looked after me, showed me around for no reason other than they wanted me to enjoy my time there. So that was, those were probably the most memorable moments, because I felt I was interacting so well with these people in a way that I didn't think was going to be possible.
Was it in Sierra Leone where people would try to sell you shards of broken glass and tell you they were diamonds?
Yes, that was there's one instance of that. I just crossed the border into Sierra Leone, and this guy just had what was very clearly just broken glass on his palm of his hand, and he was telling me they were diamonds, and we all had a good laugh about it. And Sierra Leone is known, for better and worse, for its diamonds, and there was evidence in the main towns of lawful diamond export, and that is where they are trying to make some of their money. But yeah, that was an enjoyable experience, just watching this guy prodding bits of broken glass.
Now, how about the flip side? What were the three countries that provided the most challenges, and what were those challenges?
I'll start off with Angola. That was challenging simply because it is so expensive. The cheapest hotel in Luanda, the capital, was $60 a night, and that was about half the price of every other hotel in town. Compare that to a sort of a standard price of maybe $6 or $10 in other parts of Africa. And then the food's expensive. It's a massive country. The infrastructure is not very good. And because of my other problems I had with the Democratic Republic of Congo, it meant I was in Angola for a lot longer than I planned to be. So that kind of wiped out the bank balance for quite a long time. The other difficult countries, I'll mention Eritrea simply because I didn't get in. It's a country which is closed for overland travel. It's absolutely impossible to get in there without flying into the capital and flying out of the capital. So that, on an overland trip that I was taking, just became impossible. I think Djibouti was quite challenging in the fact that normally there is a negotiation and a sort of a conversation that went on between me and locals, and in Djibouti they just didn't seem to be interested in that sort of negotiation and interaction. They just demanded ridiculous amounts of money for journeys, and they weren't hearing any of it. And basically, I had to pay that or not get where I wanted to go. So that was difficult too.
Ian, tell me about Aswan, Egypt.
Well, Aswan was really interesting. It's basically the further south town in Egypt, because I headed round Africa anti-clockwise. Or did I go clockwise? Anyway, I started in the west and headed west. So it's the first town I got to in Egypt from Sudan, and it was suddenly like re-entering Europe almost. As I said earlier, North Africa was very Mediterranean, but suddenly I was going from the dust and the strangeness, the Arabic signs of Sudan, to Aswan, which had gardens and pavements that you could walk on, and signs in English, and restaurants, and it was just almost a sensory overload of being so near home, but being still so far away.
Now, from reading your book, it seems like you're always on the go. The book is about the travel. You write a lot of times about how you don't seem to be having very pleasant experiences in a lot of these traveling that you're doing, whether it's on motorcycles or whether you're getting stuck sitting on the hard plastic handbrake. So I'm wondering, is there anything enjoyable? Is there anything enjoyable about the experience for you?
Well, I did kind of enjoy bearing that pain to a certain extent. And what it does do is it shows you how locals are traveling and having to travel every day. But what I did enjoy about that experience is if you're in a minibus with, say, 15 other people, you are very quickly part of that community. You are all strangers on that bus, so you all just start talking. Now, I was, as a foreigner, I was no different to somebody from the next town because we were all strangers. And we all very quickly got talking and sharing stories and sharing food. And it was just great to feel that I wasn't looking in, but that I was actually a part of that community for that short time I was on that piece of transport.
Speaking of communicating with these groups of people, did you find any difficulties in any language barriers?
As I mentioned before, I did basic learning on the main languages in Africa. So obviously, hopefully I had English sorted, but French, Portuguese and Arabic are those other main languages that are spoken. So I could just sort of say hello and count to 10 and things like that. But in general, Africans have an amazing propensity for languages. They will be speaking 3 or 4 languages. So if they can communicate with me from whatever languages we could muster together, they would go and find a friend who spoke English who would translate for me. So it really wasn't as big an issue as you might think it would be.
Did you ever get robbed?
I had money taken from my bag once when I wasn't there. I had stupidly left my bag in my tent in a national park, and just a little bit of money went missing. And there was an attempt to mug me on the streets of Senegal, which I managed to get away from by chance. But everyone seems always really surprised when I say there was no real robbery or mugging or threats to me during the entire journey. And the journalist I met in Cape Town was surprised I hadn't had any problems up to that point, and very surprised I hadn't got malaria yet either. So I don't know whether I was very lucky or whether the view of even people who live in Africa is very much on the negative side.
Did you take malaria medication with you?
I did, yeah.
But you didn't use it?
Oh, I used it, and I had a mosquito net, and I had insect repellent, so I was very careful about that and my health in general, I have to say.
So would you recommend to someone that may do this again in the future to go solo like you did, or would you recommend having a backup team?
I think actually having a backup team for me wouldn't have benefited the trip in any way. It may well have taken away from it, because being the sort of person I am still quite shy. Going solo and being entirely reliant on local populations for my transport, for my food, for my where I was staying the night, and for my communication, because I had no technology with me either, it meant I had to continually interact with people. And had I had a backup team, or had I had my own vehicle or a friend with me, I don't think I would have had that same necessity to interact. And so I would have learned a lot less on the trip, I think.
Early on in your journey, there's someone that's running a market, a stall in a market, I think, and he gives you a necklace with a shell on it, and he says, for good luck. And I was just curious, did you wear that throughout the rest of the journey?
I didn't wear it simply for the fact that I didn't want to look like I was a tourist who didn't know what I was doing. I was always very careful about not having jewelry on me or flashing money and just things that would mark me out as not used to traveling in such a way. But I did have it in my small little day bag I carried, just had enough space for a couple of books. So it was always by my side throughout the rest of the journey, getting it very early on. And actually, it's now sitting by my desk, hanging up. So I look on it every day.
I'm wondering what changes you've noticed from when you were in Africa previously, because one of the things you mentioned in your book is it's kind of astonishing how quickly everything is changing, perhaps because of the influence of the Chinese money coming in, but the roads themselves are being upgraded at quite a tremendous pace.
Sure. And I think if I did the same trip in 5-10 years, I would be traveling on tarmac roads all the way around, and I wouldn't be on the sort of mud I had to fight through in places like Liberia or the dusty roads of Angola. Africa now is so much better than it was on my first trip to Kenya in 2001. Then, particularly in Kenya, it was the end of the President Moi's regime, which is very heavily corrupt. And there was just this air that Kenya was sinking, and the sort of atmosphere of apprehension to the country, which had completely dissipated on returning to Kenya for in Circle Africa. And I have to say, everything is changing so quickly and for the better in almost every conceivable measure.
Ian, how did this journey change you?
Well, I'm a lot more confident in myself and what I'm doing. I'm even more willing to take risks. I'm definitely calmer as a person and less judgmental. I'm just prepared to allow things to take place. Whatever happens, happens, as I now say.
There's a line in your book where you mentioned that you use your well-honed African logic. And I was just wondering, what exactly does that mean?
I found that Africa didn't necessarily meet up with the logic of somebody who lived their life in London. So well-honed African logic was sort of my thought process that whatever I was after was in the least place I would expect it to be, basically. So if I thought the bus terminal would be in the center of town, then it would be 10 miles out of town, that sort of thing.
Ian, what's next for you?
Well, I'm currently planning my next trip. It's not all organized yet, so I don't want to say anything, but it's going to be as different to Encircle Africa as I can make it, hopefully, and I'm very excited about it. It took me a while to come up with something that drew me to it as much as Circumnavigating Africa did, but I think I've found my next project. So you'll be very shortly be able to find out about that from my website and my social media presence.
And how can people contact you if they want to learn more?